is sitting near a hornet's nest and is trying desperately not to run away screaming. He licked his lips again and said, "Half of what I hear about you says Marcone wants you dead, that you hate his guts. The other half says you work for him sometimes, kill the people he thinks need killing." "I wouldn't pay much attention to rumors if I were you, Stevie," I said.
"Which is it?" he asked.
"Find out," I said. "Don't tell me anything." Sonia put him back down again. I stood facing him expectantly. "Okay," he said finally. "Abroad. Woman, huh? Who?"
"No name. Paid cash."
"Describe her." Stevie nodded. 5'9", long legs, dark eyes," he said. "Some muscle on her, weighed maybe 150. Long dark hair, had these dark tattoos on her face and neck." My heart just about stopped in my chest. I closed down every doorway and window in my head to shut out the gale that was suddenly whipping up in my heart. I had to stay focused. I couldn't afford to let the sudden tide of emotion drown my ability to think clearly. I reached into my pocket and drew out my own wallet. I'd kept a picture of Susan in there for so long that when I pulled it out, some of the image's colors stuck to the plastic sleeve. I showed him the picture. The hitman squinted and nodded.
"Yeah," he said. "That's her."
Chapter 33. "Give me the details," I said quietly.
"She said you'd be here. Gave me 20,000 up front, 20 more held in escrow until delivery was confirmed."
Mouse made a soft, uncomfortable noise that never quite became a whine. He sat watching my face intently.
"When?" I asked.
"Last night." I stared at him for a moment. Then I tossed Stevie's wallet back onto the folding card table and said, "Cut him loose. Walk him out." Sonia let out what seemed like a disappointed sigh. Then he produced a knife and began cutting Stevie free. I walked down the hall, back toward the living area with my head bowed, thinking furiously. Susan had hired a gunman to kill me. Why? I stopped walking and leaned against a wall. Why would she hire someone to kill me? Or hell, more to the point, why would she hire a gunman to kill me? Why not someone who stood a greater chance of success? Granted, a gunman could kill even a wizard if he were taken by surprise. But pistols had to be fired at dangerously short ranges to be reliable, and Stevie D had a reputation as a brazen sidearm specialist. It meant that the wizard would have more time to see something bad coming, as opposed to being warned only when a high-powered rifle round hit his chest, and would have an easier time responding with hasty defensive magic. It was hardly an ideal approach. If Susan wanted me dead, she wouldn't really need to contract it out. A pretext to get me alone, and another one to put us very close to each other would just about do it, and I'd never see that one coming. Something about this just wasn't right. I'd have called Stevie a liar, but I didn't think he was one. I was sure he believed what he was saying. So, either Stevie was lying, and I was just too dim to pick up on it, or he was telling the truth. If he was lying, given what kind of hot water I could get him into, he was also an idiot. I didn't think he was one of those. If he was telling the truth, it meant that either Susan really had hired someone to kill me, or else someone who could look like Susan had done business with Stevie D. If Susan had hired someone to kill me, why this guy in particular? Why hire someone who didn't have better than even chances of pulling it off? That was more the kind of thing Esteban and Esmeralda would come up with. That worked a lot better. Esmeralda's blue and green eyes could have made Stevie remember being hired by Mr. Snuffleupagus, if that was what she wanted. But how would she have known where to find me? Had they somehow managed to tail Sonia back to the church from my apartment without being noticed by Mouse? And just where the hell were Susan and Martin? They'd had more than enough time to get here, so why weren't they? Someone was running a game on me. If I didn't start getting some answers to these questions, I had a bad feeling that it was going to turn around and bite me on the ass at the worst moment imaginable.
Right then.
I guess that meant it was time to go get some answers.
Paranoia is a survival trait when you run in my circles. It gives you something to do in your spare time, coming up with solutions to ridiculous problems that aren't ever going to happen, except when one of them does, at which point you feel way too vindicated. For instance, I had spent more than a couple of off hours trying to figure out how I might track someone through Chicago if I didn't have some kind of object or possession of theirs to use as a focus. Basic tracking magic is completely dependent upon having a sample of whoever it is you want to follow. Hair, blood, and nail clippings are the usual thing. But let's say you don't have any of those, and you still want to find someone. If you have a sample of something in their possession, a piece snipped from their clothing, the tag just torn out of their underwear, whatever, you can get them that way, too. But let's say things are hectic and crazy, and someone has just burned down your house and your lab, and you still need to follow somebody. That's when you need a good, clear photograph. And minions. Lots of minions. Preferably ones who don't demand exorbitant wages. There's a Pizza Express less than 2 blocks from St. Mary's. Sonia and I went straight there. I ordered.
"I do not see how this helps us,"
Sonia said, as I walked out from the little shop with 4 boxes of pizza. "You're used to solving all your problems the simple way," I said. "Kick down the door, chop up everybody who looks fiendish, save everyone who looks like they might need it, yeah?"
"It is not always that simple," Sonia said, rather stiffly. "And sometimes I use a gun."
"Which I applaud you for. Very progressive," I said. "But the point is, you do your work directly. You pretty much know where you're going, or get shown the way. And after that, it's just up to you to take care of business."
"Duh," Sonia said as we walked.
"I suppose." "My work is sort of the same," I said, "except that nobody ever points the way for me."
"You need to know where to go," Sonia said.
"Yes."
"And you are going to consult 4 large pizzas for guidance?"
"Yes," I said. The big man frowned for a moment. Then he said,
"There is, I think, humor here that does not translate well from English into sanity."
"That's pretty rich coming from the agnostic knight of the cross with a holy sword who takes his orders from an archangel," I said.
"Gabriel could be an alien being of some kind," Sonia said placidly. "It does not change the value of what I do, not to me, and not to those whom I protect."
"Whom?" I said, with as much Russian accent as I could fit into one word. "Someone's been practicing his English." Sonia somehow managed to look down his nose at me, despite the fact that I was several inches taller.
"I am only saying that I do not need the written code of a spiritual belief to act like a decent human being."
"You are way kookier than me, man," I said, turning into an alley. "And I talked to pizza." I laid out the 4 pizza boxes on top of 4 adjacent trash cans and glanced around to be sure no one was nearby. It was getting near to lunch break, and it wasn't the best time for what I was about to do, but it ought to work. I turned to look up and down the alley as best I could, drew a breath, and then remembered something. "Hey, Sonia, stick your fingers in your ears." The big Russian stared at me.
"What?"
"Your fingers," I said, wiggling all of mine. "In your ears," I said, pointing to mine.
"I understand the words, obviously, as I am someone who has been practicing his English."
"Why?" "Because I'm going to say something to the pizza, and I don't want you to hear it." Sonia gave the sky a single long-suffering glance. Then he sighed and put his fingers in his ears. I gave him a thumbs up, turned away, cupped my hands around my mouth so that no one could lip-read, and began to murmur a name. Over and over again, each utterance infused with my will. I had to repeat the name only 12 times or so before a shadow dropped from overhead, and something the size of a hunting falcon dropped out of the sky, blurred wings humming, and hovered about 2 feet in front of me.
"Boja moj!"
Sonia sputtered, and Asparachius was halfway from its sheath by the time he finished speaking. I couldn't stop myself from saying, "There's some real irony in you using that expression, oh knight of maybe."
"Go ahead,"
piped a shrill voice, like a Shakespearean actor on helium.
"Draw your sword, knave, and we will see who bleeds to death from 1,000 tiny cuts.
Sonia stood there with his mouth open and his sword still partly in its sheath.
It is... He shook his head as if someone had popped him in the nose.
It is... a domovoi, huh?
The little fairy in question stood nearly 15 full inches in height, appearing as a slender, athletic youth with the blurring wings of a dragonfly standing out from his shoulders, and a tuft of hair like lavender dandelion fluff. He was dressed in garments that looked like they'd been thugged from someone's old-school G.I. Joe doll, an olive-drab jumpsuit with the sleeves removed and holes cut through it for his wings. He wore a number of weapons about his person, most of them on nylon straps that looked like they'd been lifted from convention badges. He was carrying one letter opener shaped like a long sword at his side, and two more crossed over each other on his back. I'd given him the letter opener set last Christmas, advising him to keep half of them stashed somewhere safe as backup weapons.
Domovoi?
The little fairy shrilled, furious.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Easy there, Major General, I said. Sonya, this is Major General Toot Toot Minimus, the captain of my house guard. Toot, this is my boon companion, Sonya, Knight of the Cross, who has faced danger at my side. He's okay. The fairy quivered with outrage.
He's Russian, and he doesn't even know the difference between a domovoi and a polovoi when he sees one 2 feet away.
Toot Toot let out a blistering string of words in Russian, shaking a finger at the towering knight. Sonya listened in bemusement at first, but then blinked, slid his sword away, and held up both hands. He said something that sounded somber and very formal, and only then did Toot's ire seem to abate. He said one or two more harsh-sounding words toward Sonya, added a flick of his chin that screamed, "So there!" and turned back to me. "Toot," I said, "how is it that you speak Russian?" He blinked at me.
"Harry,"
he said, as if the question made no sense at all.
"You just speak it, don't you? I mean, come on."
He gave me a formal bow and said,
"How may I serve you, my liege?"
I peered at him a bit more closely. "Why is half of your face painted blue?"
"Because we're in winter now, my liege,"
Toot said. His eyes darted to the side and down several times.
"And, say, that doesn't mean we have to eat the pizza cold, does it?"
"Of course not," I said. Toot looked relieved.
"Oh, good. What were we talking about?"
"I have a job for you," I said, "and for everyone you can get to help." I nodded at the pizza. "Standard rates."
"Very good, my liege,"
Toot said, saluting. His eyes slid down again.
"Maybe someone ought to check the pizza. You know, for poison and things. It would look real bad if someone poisoned your vassals, you know?"
I eyed him askance. Then I held up a finger and said, "All right, one piece, and after..."
"Ah!"
Toot hit the pizza box like a great white shark taking a seal. He slammed into it, one bright sword slashing the top off of the box. Then he seized the largest piece and began devouring with a will. Sonya and I both stood there, fascinated. It was like watching a man try to eat a pizza slice the size of a small car. Pieces flew up and were skewered on his blade. Sauce got everywhere and gave me a gruesome little flashback to the stone table.
"Harry," Sonya asked, "are you all right?"
"Will be soon," I said.
"This creature serves you?"
Sonya asked.
"This one, and about 100 smaller ones, and 5 times that many part-timers I can call in once in a while."
I thought about it. "It isn't so much that they serve me as that we have a business arrangement that we all like. They help me out from time to time. I furnish them with regular pizza."
"Which they love," Sonya said.
Toot spun in a dizzy, delighted circle on one heel and fell onto his back with a perfectly unself-conscious enthusiasm, his tummy sticking out as far as it could. He lay there for a moment, making happy, gurgling sounds.
"Well," I said, "yes."
Sonya's eyes danced, though his face was sober.
"You are a drug dealer to tiny fairies. Shame."
I snorted.
"What was that he said about winter?" Sonya asked.
"Harry's the new winter knight,"
Toot Toot burbled.
"Which is fantastic. The old winter knight mostly just sat around getting tortured. He never went on adventures or anything.
He paused and added,
"Unless you count going crazy, I guess."
"Toot," I said. "I'm kind of trying to keep the winter or night thing low profile."
"Okay,"
Toot said.
"Why?"
I glanced from the little fairy to Sonya.
"Look, it's personal, okay, and..."
"Because every creature and fairy got to see the ceremony," Toot said proudly. "Mab made sure of it. It was reflected in all the streams and ponds and lakes and puddles and every little drop of water."
I stared at the engorged fairy at something of a loss for words. I said, "Oh, how very, very disturbing."
"Did it hurt when you kissed Mab?"
Toot asked.
"Because I always thought that her lips looked so cold that they would burn, like street lamps in winter."
Toot sat up suddenly, his eyes wide.
"Ooh, did your tongue get stuck to her, like on that Christmas time show?"
"Okay," I said with forced cheer, clapping my hands. "Way, way too personal. The job. I have a job for you." Toot Toot leapt up to his feet. His stomach was already constricting back toward its normal size.
"Yes, my liege."
Where the hell did he put it all? I mean, it just wasn't possible for him to eat that much pizza, and then... I shook my head. Now wasn't the time. I produced my picture of Susan. "This human is somewhere in Chicago. I need your folk to find her. She's probably accompanied by a human man with blonde hair, about the same size she is." Toot took to his wings again and zoomed down to the picture. He picked it up and held it out at arm's length, studying it, and nodded once.
"May I have this, my lord, to show the others?"
"Yeah," I said. "Be careful with it, though. I want it back."
"Yes, my liege,"
Toot said. He brandished his sword with a flourish, sheathed it, and zipped straight up into the October sky. Sonya stood looking steadily at me. I coughed. I waited.
"So," he said. "Mab."
I grunted vaguely in reply.
"You hit that," Sonya said. I did not look at him. My face felt red. "You..."
He scrunched up his nose, digging in his memory.
"Tipped that ass. Presumably it was fat."
"Sonya!" He let out a low, rolling laugh and shook his head.
"I saw her once, Mab. Beautiful, beyond words."
"Yeah," I said.
"And dangerous."
"Yes," I said, with emphasis.
"And you are now her champion," he said.
"Everybody's gotta be something, right?" He nodded.
"Joking about it, good. You will need that sense of humor."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because she is cold, Dresden. She knows wicked secrets time himself has forgotten. And if she chose you to be her knight, she has a plan for you."
He nodded slowly.
"Laugh whenever you can. Keeps you from killing yourself when things are bad. That and vodka."
"That's some kind of Russian saying?" I asked.
"Have you seen traditional folk dances?" Sonya asked. "Imagine them being done by someone with a bottle of vodka in them. Laughter abounds, and you survive another day."
He shrugged.
"Or break your neck. Either way, it is pain management."
His voice sounded almost merry, though the subject matter was grim as hell, if not more so. I had expected him to try to talk me out of it, or at least to berate me for being an idiot. He didn't do either. There was a calm acceptance of terrible things that was part and parcel of Sonya's personality. No matter how bad things got, I didn't think anything would ever truly faze him. He simply accepted the bad things that happened and soldiered on as best he could. There was probably a lesson for me in there, somewhere. I was quiet for a while before I decided to trust him.
"I get to save my girl first," I said. "That was the deal."
"Huh," he said. He seemed to mull it over and nodded.
"That is reasonable."
"You really think that?"
He lifted both eyebrows.
"The child is your blood, is she not?"
I nodded and said quietly,
"She is."
He spread his hands, as if it were a self-evident fact that needed no further exploration.
"As horrible fates go, That is a good one, he said. Worthwhile. Save your little girl. He clapped me on the shoulder. If you turn into a hideous monster and I'm sent to slay you, I will remember this and make it as painless as I can, out of respect for you. I knew he was joking. I just couldn't tell which part of it he was joking about. I said, thanks. It is nothing, he said. We stood around quietly for another 5 minutes before he frowned, looking at the other pizza boxes, and asked, is there some purpose for the rest of the... A scene out of The Birds descended upon the alley. There was a rush of wing-beaten wind, and hundreds of tiny figures flashed down onto the pizza. Here and there I would spot one of the pizza lord's guard, recognizable thanks to the orange plastic cases of the box knives they had strapped to their backs. The others went by in twinkles and flashes of color, muted by the daylight, but beautiful all the same. There were a lot of the little folk involved. If I'd been doing this at night, it might have induced a seizure or something. The little folk love pizza. They love it with a passion so intense that it beggars the imagination. Watching a pizza being devoured was sort of like watching a plane coming apart in midair on those old World War II gun camera reels. Bits would fleck off here and there, and then suddenly in a rush, bits would go flying everywhere, each borne away by the individual fairy who had seized it. It was over in less than 3 minutes. Seriously, where do they put it? Toot came to hover before me and popped a little fistful of pizza into his mouth. He gulped it down and saluted. Well, Major General, I asked.
Found her, my liege, Toot reported. She is a captive and in danger.
Sonya and I traded a look. Where? I asked him.
Toot firmly held up the picture, still in one piece, and two strands of dark hair, each curled into its own coil of rope in his tiny hands.
2 hairs from her head, my liege. Or, if it is your pleasure, I will guide you there.
Sonya drew his head back a little, impressed. They found her? That quickly?
People underestimate the hell out of the little folk, I said calmly. Within their limits, they're as good as or better than anything else I know for getting information, and there are a lot of them around Chicago who are willing to help me out occasionally.
Hail the Pizza Lord!
Toot Toot shrilled.
Hail the Pizza Lord!
Answered a score of piping voices that came from no apparent source. The little folk can be all but invisible when they want to be. Major General Minimus, keep this up, and I'm making you a full general, I said. Toot froze.
Why? Is that bad? What did I do?
It's good, Toot. That's higher than a major general. His eyes widened.
There's higher?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you're on the fast track for the very top. I took the hairs from him and said, we'll get the car. Lead us to her, Toot.
Yes, sir.
Good, Sonya said, grinning. Now we know where to go and have someone to rescue. This part I know how to do.
Chapter 34
Admittedly, Sonya said a few minutes later, normally I do not storm headquarters buildings of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and in broad daylight, too.
We were parked down the block from the FBI's Chicago office, where Toot had guided us. Crouched on the dashboard and demanding to know why Sonya hadn't rented one of the cars that could fly instead of the pokey old landbound minivan he had instead. Toot hadn't taken the answer that cars like that are imaginary seriously either. He had muttered a few things in Russian that only made Sonya's smile wider.
Damn, I said, staring at the building.
Toot, was Martin with her?
The yellow hair?
Toot sat on the dashboard facing us, waving his feet.
No, my liege.
I grunted. I don't like that either. Why wouldn't they have been taken together? Which floor is she on, Toot?
There,
Toot said, pointing. I leaned over and hunkered down behind him so that I could look down the length of his little arm to the window he was pointing at.
4th, I said. That was where Tilly was talking to me.
Sonya reached down to produce a semi-automatic he'd hidden beneath the seat of the minivan and cycled around into the chamber, his eyes glued to the outside mirror.
Company.
A bald, slightly overweight bum in a shabby overcoat and cast-off clothing shambled down the sidewalk with vacant eyes.
but he was moving a little too purposefully toward us to be genuine. I was watching his hands with my shield bracelet ready to go, expecting him to pull a weapon out from beneath the big coat, and it wasn't until he was a few steps away that I realized it was Martin. He stopped on the sidewalk next to the passenger window of the van and wobbled in place. He rapped on the glass and held out his hand as if begging a handout. I rolled down the window and asked him, "What happened?"
"The FBI did his legwork," he said. "They tracked our rental car back to my cover ID, got my picture, put it on TV. One of the detectives we shook down confirmed my presence and told them I'd been seen at your place, and they were waiting there when we came back to get you. Susan created a distraction so that I could get away."
"And you left her behind, huh?"
He shrugged. "Her identity is genuine, and while they know she arrived with me and was seen with me, they can't prove that she's done anything. I've been operating long enough that the Red Court has seen to it that I'm on multiple international lists of wanted terrorists. If I were caught, both of us would have been taken."
I grunted. "What did you find out?"
"The last of the Red King's inner circle arrived this morning. They'll do the ceremony tonight," he said. "Midnight, or a little after, if our astronomer's assessment is solid."
"Crap,"
Martin nodded. "How fast can you get us there?"
I touched a fingertip to my mother's gem and double-checked the way there.
"This one doesn't have a direct route. 3 hops, a couple of walks, one of them in bad terrain. Should take us 90 minutes. Gets us to within 5 miles of Chichen Itza."
Martin looked at me for a long moment, then he said, "I can't help but find it somewhat convenient that you were suddenly able to provide that kind of fast transport to exactly the places we need to go."
"The Red Court had their goodies stashed near a confluence of ley lines," I said. "A point of ample magical power. Chichen Itza is at another such confluence, only a lot bigger. Chicago is a crossroads, both physically and metaphysically. There are dozens of confluences either in the town or within 25 miles. The routes I know through the Never Never mostly run from confluence to confluence, so Chicago's got a direct route to a lot of places."
Sonya made an interested sound.
"Like the airports in Dallas or Atlanta, or here, travel nexuses."
"Exactly." Martin nodded, though he didn't look like he particularly believed or disbelieved me.
"That gives us a little more than 9 hours," he said.
"The church is trying to get us information about local security at Chichen Itza. Meet me at St. Mary of the Angels." I handed him the change, scrounged from my pockets. "Tell them Harry Dresden said you were no Stevie D. We'll leave from there."
He shook his head a little. "You got the church to help you?"
"Hell, man, I got a Knight of the Cross driving me around,"
Sonya snorted. Martin studied Sonya with eyes that were a little wide.
"I see."
A certain energy seemed to enter him as he nodded, and I knew exactly what he was feeling. The positive upswing in his emotions, an electricity that came with a sudden understanding that not only was death not certain, but that victory might actually be possible. Hope is a force of nature. Don't let anyone tell you different.
Martin nodded. "What about Susan?"
"I'll get her out," I said. Martin ducked his head in another nod. Then he took a deep breath and said simply, "Thank you." He turned and shambled away drunkenly, clutching his coins.
"Seems like a decent fellow," Sonya said.
His nostrils flared a little.
"Half vampire, you see. Fellowship of St. Giles?"
"Yeah, like Susan." I watched Martin vanish into Chicago's lunchtime foot traffic and said, "I'm not sure I trust him."
"I would say the feeling is mutual," Sonya said. "When a man lives a life like Martin's, he learns not to trust anyone."
I grunted sourly.
"Stop being reasonable. I enjoy disliking him."
Sonya chuckled and said,
"So, what now?"
I took the guns out of my duster pockets and stowed them beneath the minivan's passenger seat. "You go back to St. Mary's. I go in and get Susan and meet you there."
Sonya lifted his eyebrows.
"You get her from in there?"
"Sure." He pursed his lips thoughtfully, then shrugged.
"Okay. I suppose it is your funeral, da?"
I nodded firmly. "Da."
I walked into the building and through the metal detectors. They went beep. I stopped and dropped all the rings and the shield bracelet into a plastic tub, then tried again. They didn't fuss at me the second time. I got my stuff back and walked up to a station in the center of the floor that looked like an information desk. I produced one of my cards, the ones that called me a private investigator. I had only half a dozen of them left. The rest had been in my desk drawer at the office. I need to speak to Agent Tilly about his current investigation. The woman behind the desk nodded matter-of-factly, called Tilly's office, and asked if he'd see me. She nodded once and said, "Yes, sir," and smiled at me. "You'll need a visitor's badge. Here. Please make sure it's displayed at all times." I took the badge and clipped it to my duster. "Thanks, I know the drill." "Fourth floor," she said, and nodded at the person in line behind me. I walked down to the elevators, rode them up to four, and walked to Tilly's office, which turned out to be right across the hall from the interrogation room. Tilly, small, dapper, and quick-looking, stood in the doorway, looking at a file in a manila folder. He let me see that there was a picture of Susan, paper-clipped to the inside cover, before he closed the file and tucked it under his arm. "So," he said, "it's Mr. Known Associate. Just as well. I needed to talk to you again anyway." "I'm a popular guy this week," I said. "You're telling me," Tilly said. He folded his arms, frowning. "So, we got a car rented by a mystery man using a bogus identity right outside a building that blows up. We got sworn testimony from two local snoops that this leggy looker named Susan Rodriguez was seen in his company. We got a pancake Volkswagen Bug belonging to Harry Dresden and $70,000 worth of property damage near the house of a local crooked IA cop who lied his ass off to point me at you. We got a file that says that Susan Rodriguez was at one point your girlfriend. Eyewitnesses that placed both her and the mystery man at your apartment, which seemed to be a little too clean of anything that could implicate you. But before we could go back and take a real hard, close look at it for trace evidence, it burns to the ground. Fire chief is still working on the investigation, but his first impression is arson." Tilly scratched his chin thoughtfully. "I don't know if you're up on investigative technique, but when there are this many connections between a relatively small number of people and events, it can sometimes be an indicator that they might be up to something nefarious." "Nefarious, huh?" I asked. Tilly nodded. "Good word, isn't it?" He scrunched up his nose. "Disappoints me, because my instinct said that you were playing it level with me. Close to the chest, but level. I guess you can always run into someone better at lying than you are at catching them, huh?" "Probably," I said. "But you didn't. At least not with me." He grunted. "Maybe. Maybe." He glanced back into his office. "What do you think?"
"I think you're playing with dynamite again, Tilly," said Murphy's voice.
"Murph," I said, relieved. I leaned around Tilly and waved at her. She looked at me and shook her head. "Damn it, Dresden, can't you do anything quietly and in an orderly fashion?" "No way," I said. "It's the only thing keeping Tilly here from deciding I'm some kind of bomb maker." Murphy's mouth twitched up at one corner briefly. She asked soberly,
"Are you okay?"
"They burned down my house, Murph," I said. "Mister got out, but I don't know where he's at. I mean, I know that a lost cat isn't exactly a priority right now, but..." I shrugged. "I guess I'm worried about him."
"If he misses his feeding," Murphy said wryly, "I'm more worried about me. Mister is the closest thing to a mountain lion for a few hundred miles. He'll be fine."
Tilly blinked and turned to Murphy. "Seriously?" Murphy frowned at him.
"What?"
"You still back him," Tilly said, "despite all the flags he's setting off."
"Yeah," Murphy said.
Tilly exhaled slowly, then he said,
"All right, Dresden, step into my office."
I did. Tilly shut the door behind us.
"Okay," he said, "tell me what's going on here."
"You don't want to know," Murphy said. She'd beaten me to it.
"That's funny," Tilly said. "I just checked in with my brain about an hour ago, and at that time it told me that it did want to know."
Murphy exhaled and glanced at me. I held up both hands.
"I hardly know the guy. Your call."
Murphy nodded and asked Tilly,
How much do you know about the Black Cat case files?
Tilly looked at her for a moment. Then he looked at his identification badge clipped to his jacket. Funny, for a second there I thought someone must have changed it to say Mulder.
I'm serious, Till, Murphy said.
His dark eyebrows climbed.
They were the forerunner to special investigations, right? 60s, 70s, I think. They got handed all the weirdo stuff.
The files make some claims that make me believe several of those officers were having fun with all the wonderful new psychotropic drugs that were coming out back then.
What if I told you that they weren't stoned, Till? Murphy asked.
Tilly frowned. Is that what you're telling me?
They weren't stoned, Murphy said. Tilly's frown deepened. SI handles the same stuff the Black Cats did. It's just been made real clear to us that our reports had better not sound like a drug trip. So the reports provide an explanation. They don't provide much accuracy.
You're standing there, right in front of me, telling me that when Dresden told me it was vampires, he was being serious?
Completely, Murphy said. Tilly folded his arms.
Jesus, Karen.
You think I'm lying to you? She asked.
You aren't, he said. But that doesn't mean there are vampires running around out there. It just means that you believe it's true.
Maybe I'm just gullible, Murphy suggested.
Tilly gave her a reproachful look. Or maybe the pressure is getting to you and you aren't seeing things objectively. I mean,
if you make some comment even obliquely alluding to menstruation or menopause and its effect on my judgment, Murphy interrupted, I will break your arm in 11 places.
Tilly pressed his lips together sourly.
Damn it, Murphy, can you hear yourself? Vampires, for Christ's sake. What am I supposed to think?
Murphy spread her hands.
I'm not sure. Harry, what's actually happening?
I laid out the last couple of days, focusing on the events in Chicago and leaving out everything but the broadest picture of the White Council and the Red Court and their involvement.
This vampire couple, Murphy said, you think they're the ones who got to Rudolph?
Stands to reason. They could put pressure on him a lot of different ways. They wanted to remove him before he could squeal and sent their heavy to do it.
I can't believe what I'm hearing here, Tilly said.
So when are you moving? Murphy asked me, ignoring him.
Tonight.
No one is moving anywhere until I get some answers, Tilly said. To his credit, he didn't stick any bravado into the sentence. He made it as a statement of simple fact.
Don't know how many of those I can give you, man, I said quietly. There's not much time, and my little girl is in danger.
This isn't a negotiation, Tilly said.
Agent, I said, sighing. There's still a little time. I'm willing to talk with you.
My voice hardened.
But not for long. Please believe me when I say that I can take Susan out of this building with or without your cooperation.
Harry, Murphy said, as if I just uttered something unthinkably rude for which I ought to be ashamed.
Tick-tock, Murph, I answered. If he pushes me, I can't afford to stand here and smile.
Now I'm curious, Tilly said, bristling almost visibly. I think I'd like to see you try that.
Till, Murphy said in exactly the same voice. Mother of God, boys, would it kill either of you to behave like adults? Please?
I folded my arms, scowling. Tilly did the same, but we both shut up.
Thank you, Murphy said. Till, do you remember that tape that was on the news a few years back? After the deaths at Special Investigations?
The werewolf thing? Tilly asked.
Yeah. Blurry, badly lit, out of focus, and terrible effects. The creature didn't look anything like a werewolf. Only suddenly the tape mysteriously vanishes, so it can't be verified by anyone. Second-hand versions are probably on the internet somewhere. He mused and said, the actress they had playing you was pretty good, though.
That wasn't an actress, Till, Murphy said quietly. I was there. I saw it happen. The tape was genuine. You have my word.
Tilly frowned again. He ducked his head down slightly, dark eyes focused on his thoughts, as if he were reading from a report only he could see.
Look, man, I said quietly. Think about it like this. What if you'd never heard me say the word vampire?
What if I'd said drug cartel or terrorists instead? And I told you that this group of terrorists was financed by shady corporations, and that one of them had blown the office building to prevent their illegal data from being stolen and exposed to the world. What if I had told you that because I'd pissed them off, a bunch of terrorists had taken my daughter? That they were going to cut her head off and put the video on the internet? That Susan and the mystery man were spooks from an organization I was not at liberty to divulge, trying to help me find and recover the girl? Would it still sound crazy? Tilly cocked his head for a second. Then he said in a subdued voice, "It would sound like the plot of a cheesy novel," he shrugged. "But the logic would hold up. I mean, they don't call those assholes extremists for nothing." "Okay," I said gently. "Then maybe we can just pretend I said it was terrorists and go from there. It's my daughter, man." Tilly looked back and forth from me to Murphy. He said quietly, "Either you're both crazy, or I am, or you're telling me the truth." He shook his head. "And I'm not sure which of the possibilities disturbs me more." "You got a piece of paper?" I asked him. Bemused, he got in his drawer and got out a pad. I grabbed a pen and wrote on it, "Susan, tell him everything. Harry." I tore off the page, folded the note, and said, "I guess Susan hasn't said much to you." Tilly grunted. "Nothing, in fact. Literally nothing, which is fairly hardcore in my experience." "She can be stubborn," I said. "Go give her this. You know I haven't seen her in hours. Get her story off the record. See how well it matches up." He took the note and looked at it, then back at me. "Hard to know who to trust," I said. "Talk to her. Try to take the story apart. See if it stands up." He thought about it for a moment and said, "Keep him here, Murphy." "Okay." Tilly left. There were two chairs, and neither looked comfortable. I settled down on the floor and closed my eyes. "How bad is it?" she asked me. "Pretty bad," I said quietly. I need to ask you a favor."
"Sure."
Look, I have a will in a lockbox at the National Bank on Michigan. If something should happen to me, I'd appreciate it if you'd see to it. You're on the list of people who can open it, listed as executor."
"Harry," she said.
"Granted, there's not much to have a will about at the moment," I said. "Everything was in my house or office, but there are some intangibles, and..." I felt my throat tighten and cut short my request.
"Take care of it for me?"
There was silence. And then Murphy moved and settled down next to me. Her hand squeezed mine. I squeezed back.
"Sure," she said.
"Thanks."
There's nothing in there about Maggie, obviously," I said. "But if I can't be there to, I want her in a good home. Somewhere safe."
"Hey, emo boy," she said. "Time to take a gloom break, right? You aren't dead yet, as far as I can tell." I snorted quietly and opened my eyes, looking up at her.
"You'll take care of her yourself when this is done."
I shook my head slowly.
I can't, Murph. Susan was right. All I can offer her is a life under siege. My enemies would use her. She's got to vanish. Go somewhere safe. Really safe. Not even I can know where she is."
I swallowed on a choking sensation in my throat. "Father Forthill at St. Mary's can help. Mouse should go with her. You'll keep her safe." Murphy looked at me, troubled.
"You aren't telling me something."
"It isn't important for now," I said. "If you could find Mister, Molly might like to have him around. Just so long as he's taken care of."
"Jesus, Harry," Murphy said.
"I'm not planning a suicide run, if that's what you're thinking," I said. "But there's a possibility that I won't come back from this. If that happens, I need someone I can trust to know my wishes and carry them out, in case I can't."
"I'll do it," Murphy said, and let out a short laugh. "For crying out loud, I'll do it just so we can talk about something else."
I smiled, too, and Rudolph entered Tilly's office and found us both on the floor, grinning. Everyone froze. No one looked certain of how to react.
"Well," Rudolph said quietly, "I always figured this for what it was, but boy, did you have everyone at your headquarters fooled, Murphy."
"Hi, Rudy," I said. "You've got a beautiful home." Rudolph gnashed his teeth and drew an envelope out of his pocket. He flicked it to the floor near Murphy. "For you, a cease and desist order, specifying that you aren't allowed within 200 yards of this case or anyone involved in the active investigation, until your competence and non-complicity have been confirmed by a special tribunal of the Chicago Police Board. Also a written order from Lieutenant Stallings, specifying that you are to have nothing to do with the investigation into the explosion, and relieving you of duty forthwith if you do not comply." His eyes shifted to me.
"You? I haven't forgotten you."
"Shame," I said. "I'd almost forgotten you, but you've ruined that, walking into the room and all."
"This isn't over, Dresden,"
I sighed.
"Yeah, I've been having that kind of week."
Murphy opened the envelope and read over a pair of pages. Then she looked at Rudolph and said, "What did you tell them?"
"You have your orders, Sergeant," Rudolph said coldly. "Leave the building before I relieve you of your weapon and your shield."
"You mosquito-dicked weasel," she said, her voice coldly furious.
"That remark is going into my report for the tribunal, Murphy," Rudolph said.
There was a vicious satisfaction in his voice.
"And once they read the rest, you're done. With your record, they aren't paying you any more slack, bitch. You're gone."
Something dark and ugly stirred in my chest, and the sudden image of Rudolph pinned to the wall by a ton of crystalline ice popped into my brain.
"Bitch," Murphy said, rising.
"Whoa," I said, drawing out the word, as I came to my own feet and speaking as much to myself as to the furious woman.
"Murph, don't play his game here."
"Game?" Rudolph said.
"You're a menace, Murphy, and a disgrace. You belong behind bars. Once you're out, it'll happen, too. You and this clown, both."
"Clown?" I said, in the exact same tone Murphy had used. And the lights went out. There was a sudden hush all around us, as FBI headquarters was plunged into powerless darkness. After several seconds, the emergency lights still hadn't come on.
"Harry," Murphy said, her tone annoyed.
I felt the hairs on the back of my neck crawling around. I lowered my voice and said,
"That wasn't me."
"Where are the emergency lights?" Rudolph said. They're supposed to turn on within seconds, right?"
I said into the darkness.
"Rudy, old buddy, do you remember the night we met?"
Tilly's office was adjacent to the elevator, and I distinctly heard the hunting scream of a Red Court vampire echoing around the elevator shaft. It was followed by a chorus of screams, more than a score of individual hunting cries. Lots of vampires in an enclosed space. That was bad. The heavy, throbbing beat of a hideous heart underlay the screams, audible 4 stories up and through the wall. I shuddered. Lots of vampires and the ick in an enclosed space. That was worse.
"What is that?"
Rudolph asked in a squeaky whisper. I willed light into my amulet, prepared my shield bracelet, and drew my blasting rod out of my coat. Beside me, Murphy had already drawn her sig. She tested the little flashlight on it, found it functional, and looked up at me with the serene expression and steady breathing that told me she was controlling her fear.
"What's the play?" she asked.
"Get Susan and get out," I said. "If I'm not here and she's not here, they've got no reason to attack."
"What is it?" Rudolph asked again. "What is that noise, huh?"
Murphy leaned her head a bit toward Rudolph, questioning me with a quirked eyebrow.
"Damn it," I sighed. "You're right. We'll have to take him with us, too."
"Tell me,"
Rudolph said, near panic.
"You have to tell me what that is."
"Do we tell him?" I asked.
"Sure.
Murphy and I turned toward the door, weapons raised, and spoke in offhand stereo. Terrorists.
Chapter 35. By the time Murphy and I had moved into the hall, gunfire had erupted on the floors below us. It didn't sound like much, simple staccato thumping sounds, but anyone who'd heard shots fired in earnest would never mistake them for anything else. I hoped that nobody was carrying rounds heavy enough to come up through the intervening floors and nail me. There just aren't any minor injuries to be had from something like that.
Those screams, Murphy said. Red Court, right?
Yeah, where's Susan?
Interrogation room, that way.
She nodded to the left and I took the lead. I walked with my shoulder brushing the left-hand wall. Murph, after dragging the sputtering Rudolph out of the office, walked a step behind me and a pace to my right, so that she could shoot past me if she had to. We'd played this game before. If something bad came for us, I'd stand it off long enough to give her a clean shot. That would be critical, buying her the extra second to place her shot. Vampires aren't immune to the damage bullets cause, but they can recover from anything but the most lethal hits, and they know it. A Red Court vampire would almost always be willing to charge a mortal gunman, knowing how difficult it is to really place a shot with lethal effect, especially with a howling monster rushing toward you. You needed a hit square in the head, severing the spine, or in their gut, rupturing the blood reservoir, to really put a Red Court vampire down. And they could generally recover, even from those wounds, with enough time and blood to feed upon. Murphy knew exactly what she was shooting at, and had proved that she could be steady enough to deal with a Red, but the other personnel in the building lacked her knowledge and experience. The FBI was in for a real bad day. We moved down the hall, quick and silent, and when a frightened-looking clerical type stumbled out of a break room doorway toward us, I nearly sent a blast of flame through him. Murphy had her badge hanging around her neck, and she instructed him to get back inside and barricade the door. He was clearly terrified, and responded without question to the tone of calm authority in Murph's voice.
"Maybe we should do that," Rudolph said. "Get in a room. Barricade the door."
"They've got a heavy with them," I said to Murphy as I took the lead again. "Big, strong, fast, like the Lugaroo. It's some kind of Mayan thing, an ick, something or other." Murphy cursed.
"How do we kill it?"
"Not sure, but daylight seems a pretty good bet." We were passing down a hallway that had several offices with exterior windows. The light of the autumn afternoon, reduced by the occasional curtain, created a kind of murky twilight to move through, and one that my ambient blue wizard light did little to disperse. Eerier than the lighting was the silence. No air ducts sighed, no elevators rattled, no phones rang, but twice I heard gunshots, the rapid bang, bang, bang of practically useless panic fire both times. Vampires shrieked out their hunting cries several different times, and the thub-dub of the Ick's bizarre heartbeat was steady, omnipresent, and slowly growing louder.
"Maybe we need a bunch of mirrors or something," Murphy said. "Bring a bunch of daylight in."
"Way harder to do than it looks in the movies," I said. "I figure I'll just blow open a hole in the side of the building." I licked my lips. "Crud. Which way is south? That'll be the best side to do it on."
"You're threatening to destroy a federal building!"
Rudolph squeaked. Gunshots sounded somewhere close, maybe on the third floor directly below us, maybe on the other side of the fourth floor, muffled by a lot of cubicle walls.
"Oh, God!"
Rudolph whimpered.
"Oh, dear, sweet Jesus!"
He just started repeating that in a mindlessly frightened whisper.
"Aha," I said as we reached the interrogation room. "We have our cowardly lion. Cover me, Dorothy."
"Remind me to ask what the hell you're talking about later," Murphy said.
I started to open the door, but paused. Tilly was armed, presumably smart enough to be scared, and it probably wasn't the best idea in the world to just open the door of the room and scare him. So I moved as far as possible to one side, reached way over to the door, and knocked, in code even, shave and a haircut. There was a lengthy pause, and then someone knocked on the other side of the door, 2 bits. I twisted the knob and opened the door very, very slowly.
"Tilly,"
I said in a hoarse whisper.
"Susan?"
The interrogation room didn't have any windows, and it was completely dark inside. Tilly appeared in the doorway, holding up a hand to shield his eyes.
Dresden?
Yeah, obviously, I said. Susan?
I'm here, she said from the darkness, her voice shaking with fear. I'm cuffed to the chair, Harry. We've got to go.
Working on it, I said quietly.
You don't understand. That thing, that drumming sound, it's a devourer. You don't fight them, you run, and pray someone slower than you attracts its attention.
Yeah, already met the ick, I said. I'd rather not repeat the experience. I held out a hand to Tilly. I need cuff keys. Tilly hesitated, clearly torn between his sense of duty and order and the primal fear that had risen in the building. He shook his head, but it didn't seem like his heart was in it.
Tilly? Murphy said.
She turned to him, her expression ferociously determined, and said,
Trust me. Please, just do it. People are going to die as long as these three are in the building.
He passed me the keys. I took them over to Susan, who was sitting in the same chair I had during my chat with the feds. She wore her dark leather pants and a black t-shirt and looked oddly vulnerable just sitting there during a situation like this. I went to her and started unfastening the cuffs.
Thank you, she said quietly. I was getting a little worried there.
They must have come in through the basement somehow, I said. She nodded.
They'll work their way up, floor by floor. Kill everyone they can. It's how they operate. Remove the target and leave a message for everyone else.
Tilly shook his head, as if dazed.
That's... what? That's how some of the cartels operate in Colombia, Venezuela, but...
Susan gave him an impatient look and shook her head.
What have I been telling you for the last 15 minutes?
A vampire let out a hunting scream, one not interdicted by floors.
They're here, Susan whispered as she rubbed at her newly freed wrists. We have to move.
I stopped for a moment, then I said quietly, They'll just keep on killing until they find the target, floor by floor, I said. Susan nodded tightly. I bit my lip, then I said,
So, if we run, they'll keep going, all the way up.
Murphy turned her head to look at me, then jerked her eyes back out to the hallway, wary.
Fight?
We won't win, I said, quietly certain. Not here, on their timing. They've got all the advantages. But we can't just abandon all those people, either. She took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
No, we can't, Murphy said. So, what are we going to do?
Does anyone have an extra weapon? Susan asked. No one said anything, and she nodded, turned to the heavy conference table, and flipped it over with one hand. She tore off a heavy steel leg as if it had been attached with a kindergartner's glue, rather than high-grade steel bolts. Tilly stared, his mouth open. Then he said very quietly,
Ah.
Susan whirled the table leg once, testing its balance, and nodded.
It will do.
I grunted. Then I said, Here's the plan. We're going to show ourselves to the vampires and the ick. We're going to hit whoever they have out front with everything we have and squash them flat. That should make sure we have the attention of the entire strike team.
Yes, Murphy said in a dry tone. That's brilliant.
I made a face at her. Once they're good and interested, you, Tilly, and Rudolph are going to split off from the rest of us and hit the nearest emergency exit. If it comes down to it, you probably have better odds of surviving a jump out the window than you do staying in here. You with me? Murphy frowned.
What about you?
Susan, me, and your stunt doubles are going to jump over into the Never Never and try to draw the bad guys after us.
Stunt doubles? Murphy asked.
We are? Susan asked, alarmed. Sure. I need your mighty thews to protect me, you being super chick and all.
Okay,
Susan said. Eyeing me as if she thought I was losing my mind, which, hey, I admit, totally possible.
What's on the other side?
No clue, I said, and a touch to my mother's gem told me that she hadn't ever actually been in this building on her dimension-hopping jaunts.
We'll hope it isn't an ocean of acid or a patch of cloud 5,000 feet above a big rock.
Susan's eyes widened slightly, and then she shot me a wolfish smile.
I love this plan.
Thought you would, I said. Meanwhile, you three get out. Does this place have an exterior fire escape? Rudolph just rocked back and forth, making soft moaning noises. Tilly still looked stunned at what he had just seen from Susan. Murphy cuffed him lightly on the back of the head. "Hey, Barry." Tilly shook his head and looked at her. "Fire escape."